Hey, our special guest in the studio is John Eric Vining. John is a local author here, and John, you write primarily about history. We had a long discussion on the show here a few years back about the War of 1812 and other events that have taken place in our state, in our area, and so forth. And your new book is called Violet Lightning, A Blueprint for Japanese Victory in the Pacific, 1941-1942. How did you get interested in that particular aspect?
Kind of an interesting story. My brother and I were both history nuts, and we both grew up on a small farm. And while we were working on the machinery at times, we would start talking about history stuff. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days, we had to grease it and check the belts. And he was standing on top of the combine. We were arguing about, that sounds kind of geeky, but we were arguing about Germany had a chance to win World War II, but Japan never did. And we were arguing back and forth, and finally he just glowers down and states, "Look, Japan couldn't win it. You got it?" And that kind of stuck with, well, he's 6'4 and about 240, so yeah, that was the end of the discussion right then.
Definitely stuck with you.
I got it. But it stuck with me all these years. Why in the world would they start?
Well, you know, and I know where you're going with this, because Germany, Hitler always wanted air superiority, and he could never get it because of the combination, of the United States and England?
Right.
Primarily, good planes in the Spitfires and in the planes that America was flying before the P-51s even, but he could never get that Luftwaffe to be what he wanted it to be.
He did it until he ran up against Britain. He did it against Poland. He did it in the Low Countries. He did it against France. But then he ran up against some pretty tough, we called them Playboy pilots, and they were flying pretty good planes, and they knew where they were coming. The funny thing is that with radar, they knew which direction they would come, and they just had a few planes, but they could put them right where the Germans were coming, and they shot a lot of bombers down. They couldn't invade Britain.
And then later in the war, Hitler got radar, but it didn't really help him either.
It helped him, but not enough.
Yeah.
It was too late then. We had too much.
But now you look at the Japanese who have thought about this for a long period of time.
Well, and again, I thought, nobody starts a fight knowing they're going to get... Why did they do it? And you have to go all the way back to the turn of the century before that. They had fought both China and Russia on either side of the turn of the century. And in both of those, they had won by just rapid blows, just boom, boom, boom. And every time, they call that escalation dominance in today's term.
Shock and awe.
Shock and awe.
That's right. Sure.
And when they did that, both China and Russia quit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were just going to stand in for China and Russia. First of all, they thought we weren't going to fight because of isolationism, and then we stood on the sidelines for 2 years while Hitler dominated Europe. So they looked back and said, they're not going to fight. They're just not going to do it. We can take what we want.
But they had a good product in that Mitsubishi Zero.
They did for a while.
That was a moving machine that far outperformed most of the things that we had, right?
For 1942, it did. But a funny thing is, it was a one-shot weapon. And when we captured one in the Aleutians during the Battle of Midway, we found out it wasn't that much better, and there were ways to attack it.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost their dominance. Once we figured out what it was, we built a thing called the Grumman Hellcat, specifically to combat the Zero. And once they lost the ability to control the local airspace, their bombers were no good either, and they got all shot down. And bigger than that, they lost all their pilots. They would send them on these long missions. They would go down with the planes, and they couldn't train them fast enough to replace them.
Talk about it. I know you've probably studied also the kamikaze, the divine wind. Talk about where they got those kids from to fly those. And how much training they might not have had.
They did not. Japan was a very ordered society, and the emperor was God on earth. So when the emperor said, you must trade your life for 50 Americans, what you're going to do is you're going to take your plane and you're going to go down and you're going to hit a ship, and maybe you by yourself will kill 50 to 100 or maybe 1,000 if the ship goes down.
If you hit it the right place.
It in the right place. Mm-hmm. And so we're asking you, we can't fight them conventionally anymore. He didn't say that, but that's what he was saying. We're asking you to trade your life for, and they had this kamikaze attitude where we want to die in the divine service of our emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And so they stepped up and did it. And they were very poorly trained. Most of them got shot down before they got anywhere as close to our our ships.
But so the emperor is almost a religious figure in this case.
He was a religious figure.
So what do we, what parallels can we draw then with the Islamic State and the people who would drive those airplanes into our World Trade Center? A very similar type of a thought process with a religious overtone to it.
The Japanese died for the emperor, who was the embodiment of God. My understanding is they die for a reward in heaven, of a massive reward. Mm-hmm. There's things that are
72
told about.
Virgins.
That's
yeah.
what I heard.
Thanks for letting me go there.
Yeah, I was going to say that. 72 virgins. Anyway.
Except the joke's on them. It was actually 72 Virginians.
Translation didn't work right. But anyway, they do the same thing for a religious reward, but it's similar in concept where and of course we're infidels, so what makes a difference?
Here the Japanese really are you saying that because the book says 1941 to 1942, you're saying they really only dominated for a year?
For a year, they had a chance to win it with the rapid blows. Remember, we're fighting Germany. If they could have sunk enough ship and killed enough Americans, perhaps we would have had to go to the. Why were we fighting? Were we fighting to restore Britain to Hong Kong and Singapore? Were we fight the Dutch to the Dutch East Indies? People might have started saying, why are we doing this? Because remember, only 26 years later in Vietnam, that attitude was widespread. Yep. Why are we fighting over there?
Yeah.
So it could have, Roosevelt stopped it with, so help us God, we're going to get back. So that was a little bit different. But on FDR, the other hand, it was the same people.
FDR really didn't have an interest in fighting, did he?
He had an interest in saving the Atlantic connection.
Okay. Well, do you explore in your book, what if Japan would have just continued to try to dominate Asia and not attack the United States?
There is a theory. In fact, the German Ribbentrop, he was the foreign minister. He went to him and says, don't attack the Philippines. Don't attack Hawaii. Just go down past them and take the East India. Dutch can't do anything about it. The Americans won't fight you to save European hegemony. Mm-hmm. But these guys were militarists. You don't march with a huge enemy on your flank. You don't march past a group with a huge enemy on your flank. Well, we were in the Philippines because we took that in the Spanish-American War.
But at the time, we might not have even cared about that. Hawaii wasn't even a state yet. I'm not sure we would have cared about the Philippines.
You've hit that right on the money, because we said we were not going to get engaged in wars, foreign territory war. Well, there's only 48 states back then, and Alaska and Hawaii and the Philippines were not states. So again, they kind of thought in their mind, well, maybe they just won't fight. Maybe we can just take this stuff.
Was it the doggedness of the Japanese soldier, the Bushido attitude, that that prevented us from wrapping this thing up long before we ever did? We had to go we had to clean out the Marshall Islands and Iwo Jima and the Saipan and all those other places, one by one by one, with incredible casualty and death rates.
They were told to fight to the last man, and they did it because...
Is that why they were able to extend it out to 1944, for example, 45?
You look at Tarawa and you look at Saipan, we had to root every one of them out at bayonet point almost, because they just weren't going to give up, because they had been told by God to fight to the last man.
I wonder what, and I've often thought about this, I wonder what the drawbacks would have been to just isolating and cutting off those islands, just saying, hey, stay there if you want. You're all going to starve to death. We're not letting anything in or out.
It was known as island hopping.
We'll pick you up on the beach, but we're not going to fight you because we don't need to.
And that's what happened both. Finally, that's what won the war for us, both with Nimitz in the Central Pacific and in the Southwest Pacific with MacArthur. They did island hopping where they didn't take Rabaul and they didn't take Truk. They just bombed them, and what they would use them for, it sounds kind of they would use them to train. We would use them to train our young pilots. We would go around them, and then every once in a while we'd send something to bomb Rabaul so that these guys could get experience, because it was withering on the vine, and they didn't have much ammo, and they didn't have much left, but it was experience. So they did use that, island hopping.
When did you write this book? How long ago was that?
Well, it took me a long, long time, because this was back when I was kids. I started thinking about it. So I've been doing research. I've probably been researching it since I was 10 to 15 years old, reading stuff and building information. I actually put pen to paper 25 years ago.
Is that right?
It took a long, long time. Not steady. I'd work on it for a while, and then I'd hit a snag, and I'd say, I'll put it aside and write something else.
And my wife would ask this question, and it's a legitimate question. A lot of women ask the question. A lot of men ask the question. You know, why are some of us so fascinated with war? I know I am.
If you think about history, if you go back, which after 50 years I have, there's only been very short periods when we haven't been at war. Most of democracy, most of interpersonal relationships for mm-hmm. recorded mankind are the history of conflict.
And we're fighters.
We're fighters.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why we're beating the COVID virus. We fight. Most Americans, particularly Americans, since we came over here to do mm-hmm. it, we don't back down that much. And mankind's kind of like that. Your first thing is, if you go back in a corner, you're going to get killed. You better meet it up front and take your chances.
Any oh wow moments regarding the research and writing of this book where you went, oh wow, I didn't know that?
There was. It was like, I would work for a while, then I would read something else. And I came to Vietnam and I read the history of the Tet Offensive. And we just beat the North Vietnamese to a pulp. And yet it came back here that we, because it had taken us so long to do it, that we were losing. That was what the word was. Tet was the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
Well, what if the Japanese could have done that?
Mm-hmm.
They could have beaten us, and we had a huge battle, what they called the decisive battle, and we lost. Or we won, but it cost us thousands and thousands of men that could have been fighting the Germans.
And I think we're getting better stats. You know, back in those days during the Second World War in Vietnam, I think the number of North Vietnamese that came across the border, across the DMZ down into South Vietnam, was about 490,000, mm-hmm. somewhere in that range. And it was reported at really about 150,000. And the Secretary of Defense at the time, McNamara, said, well, this is doable. I think if he'd have known there was a 500,000 in there that came across that border in January of 68, he'd made some different decisions.
And, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was pumping supplies in. Yeah. They were pretty...
Well, my brother was flying the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Yeah,
they were a lot better supplied, and they were a lot stronger than what they thought. And we had mm-hmm. sold this, that we're beating them, and we're beating the North Vietnamese, and we're beating the Viet Cong. And all of a sudden, this Tet Offensive breaks out, and we got thousands of killed, and it looks like we're losing. Saigon almost fell.
Yeah.
Wei
did
fall.
Tell us about the title. I thought you had called it Violent Lightning, but it's Violet Lightning.
The Japanese had the ability to build. They had the ability to build planes that might have changed the course of the war. They built great airframes, kind of like we did with the Mustang. Mm-hmm. They built great airframes, but they had trouble building powerful engines. The engine on the Zero wasn't very powerful. One of those planes was called the Violet Lightning, the Kawanishi Shiden Kai. If they had been able to build an engine, which they could have, what did we do when we didn't have an engine? We went to Britain and we got the Merlin and bolted on there and we had the best plane. Well, the Germans were building great engines. They were building
Messerschmitts, right?
Mm-hmm. They were building Focke-Wulf radial engine, is a radial engine like the Zero.
Mm-hmm.
If they could have done what we did, we did it. What if they said, yeah, we're going to be fighting the Americans someday. We'll just set you some jigs up and we'll set you some stuff and we'll let you license build our engine. If they'd had that plane, the Violet Lightning and several others,
that's what surprised me about the Germans, because they have that engineering mindset, you know, and they had that thing for perfection, and it surprised me that they didn't.
What's that? It slowed them up.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, you think so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet. The Japanese were cranking. Well, you remember the stuff that was shipped over here after the war.
Yeah.
We say, well, that's cheap Japanese stuff. You know, they would build things to work, but not all that long, because they didn't really need it all that long. They had an idea how they were going to do things.
You had a really interesting point about Japanese or German precision. I saw a story. I saw a documentary one time. They were rebuilding a German engine. This was in the 80s or 90s. And this guy was talking, and he was a British engineer. He said, for heaven's sakes, don't mess up the crankshaft because it's so precise, we can't build it with our computerized stuff today.
Yeah.
That's how precise they were.
But why would you want to, there's no need to send that kind of quality into war. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
We did the same thing. We had the Thompson machine gun. It was a great weapon, mm-hmm. but it cost a lot and it was heavy. We built this little grease gun, M3.
Yep.
It was stamped parts. Mm-hmm. Did the same thing for a third of the cost.
During
the
Vietnam unless era. It offers you a superiority.
Like the M1 Garand.
Yeah.
which offered a huge superiority.
The Vietnam days, GE, General Electric, built a Gatling gun. And, you know, when it worked, it was great, but it didn't work most of the time. So you had to have, for every kid you had behind the Gatling gun running it, you had two or three General Electric engineers, contractors, who were over there trying to keep the thing running.
Well, let me tell you, it works now, and that is one they still use, and it's a mean weapon.
It's a drill. It sounds like a drill. Yeah. It fires just that quickly.
It's a mean weapon.
I won't imitate it here on the radio. but anyway, you know, John, always great to have you here on the show. We need to do this more often. I could sit and talk history with you by the hour on this radio
station. You could leave us off and have this show, right, Chris? Is this an Amazon book? Where can we get this, John?
Oh, okay, yes. It is on Amazon. It's hot off the press. In fact, my website's not updated yet. It will be within a week or
two.
That's
JohnEricVining with a V.com, right?
Yeah, JohnEricVining.com.
Violet Lightning.
Violet Lightning and a blueprint, because they did need to win it by the end of 1942. After that, our submarines took over. We got our weapons together. We got our tactics and strategies together. And more than that, we got our broken codes. They couldn't do anything that we didn't know about.
That was the Midway deal.
Yeah. Well, it was even worse after 1940. They didn't have a chance to do anything. I mean, it was over after 1942. If they
and
didn't
we captured
us-
Enigma, too, right? That was a game changer. We got their code.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. It is on Amazon, though.
Good.
And it'll be on several other sites, Barnes & Noble, before long, but it's literally hot off the press.
Excellent. John, thanks for coming in. JohnEricVining is with us today.
Thank you very much.
Stan and Thad, thank you both for being here today. Todd's our producer, and his honor, the mayor of the city of Van Wert, Ken Marquardt. Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. And we'll catch you next weekend here, the Mayor's Conference and the Commissioner's Corner.